นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิ
We've reached the evening of our third day of retreat, and we have some time for reflection tonight. If you haven't yet found the time to relax today, this is a good time to start to relax. Ajahn Sonet asked if I'd be willing to give some reflections and say something tonight. And more than happy to. I was kind of expecting that I might have to say something last night. I considered it sort of demonstrative of Ajahn's great metta and compassion. Gave a few talks the first few days, kind of offering me a chance, even as all of us, to kind of just settle into the retreat experience here. So that's a just kind of sweet feeling, very nice. And I hope, like many of you, that you are sort of feeling some sort of progression, sort of as the days go by. I've been on many retreats, having lived in monasteries for just a little short of 20 years. And I kind of don't like to make much of it, but there does seem to be something about this first couple of days of a kind of shift in schedule. And I don't think it's isolated just to retreats. I think it can have kind of maybe broader sort of effects. Like one thing that people have done fasting a lot, which sometimes monks kind of get into this thing. There seems to be some magical thing about 72 hours when you're fasting as well. So, you know, it might not be you and your mind and your lousy defilements. It could just be a bunch of chemistry. Or partly that's maybe some of the answer too, just shifting environments. And it takes a while for the cortisol and the hormones and the chemistry to kind of shift and sort of settle. So Ajahn's advice to just kind of relax these first couple of days and let that process kind of proceed. It's very good advice. And when I'm sort of talking with people and teaching, I kind of get this sense that you can't remind people enough to relax. You can't remind people enough to keep kind of practicing sort of letting go of ideas, images, and expectations that you have for yourself in your practice or even in your life. It seems kind of epidemic, maybe especially so in our times, that we have these very firm attachments and views about who should be, who we shouldn't be, what we should be experiencing when, how things should progress. The more I become a kind of a senior monk and have some teaching duties and interview with people and talk to people as I do on a daily basis, the more you realize just how much of our suffering is built up of this kind of incongruence between the kind of images and identities and expectations that we create and the very real kind of terrain that we're experiencing. And I can say it till I'm blue in the face, but most people still won't really take it to heart, or if they do, it only lasts for a few minutes. Because, the reality is we're oftentimes not yet at that place where we really can just drop it. So, but it is unnecessary. I mean, it's a bit like being on a mountaineering expedition, and you're trying to climb. Well, most of you are from the Portland area, so let's call it Mount Hood. And you're on this kind of hike, and you're going to climb Mount Hood, and you come over, sort of one set of hills or a pass, and you start thinking, "Wow, this is it. Now we're gonna hit the final ascent." And then you find, no, you need to come down and go through another pass. Goes up. The reality is, you don't need the expectation, and you don't need maybe the disappointment or the judgment when you discover that the terrain doesn't sort of match your image. It doesn't match your ideal. It doesn't match your expectation. The terrain is just the terrain. You don't really have to think about it in that way. You don't really have to kind of create a whole set of desires and attachments and expectations about how long it's going to take, about how the trip or the journey will unfold. That's really in this path of unwinding your suffering, that's really an obstacle, and that's really just a whole lot of extra baggage and heaviness. The real work is just with sincerity and awareness, applying yourself step by step, moment by moment, to the practice and the path, and just letting that journey take its way and unwind as it does. And trusting in that way, trusting in the effort, trusting in the awareness. The good news is the spiritual ascent or the spiritual journey, the spiritual path, is different than climbing Mount Hood. The train of Mount Hood is fixed. It's going to take you a certain number of miles, and you're going to have to cover a certain kind of terrain, depending how you approach it. It's fixed. But your process of spiritual maturation and learning how to free yourself, it isn't fixed. That isn't a fixed terrain. And so in some ways it's even more unknowable. I mean, we could zoom in Google Earth or go get some nice maps at REI and get a little preview of what the terrain is. We're going to climb it. But you won't find any such things in Google. or down at the camping store. So give it up. Give up. Give up trying to figure it out. Really, just when you find yourself constructing these images and these expectations, or you start hearing that should word in your mind, or you start feeling a kind of welling of frustration or disappointment in the midst of a sit or at the end of a sit. That's a byproduct that you've been kind of suckered again. Just brush it away. Just brush it away. Say, oh, well, that's not it. I don't need that. That's just complicating my path. All I really need to do is come back to sincerely awakening to the present moment and putting forth right effort. And although it's not easy, I mean, it really is an important kind of part of the practice, because this habit kind of creeps into our practice in many different ways. I'm sure before we came up here, you spent some time thinking about what your 10 days of Birkin are going to be like, even though you've never been here, for some of you. And you probably went through all kinds of mental machinations of, well, you know, my health is pretty good right now, and my practice has been like this, and I've been on these retreats before, and, well, I saw Ajahn Sonam when he was in Portland, and I heard his talks there, and those were kind of nice, and somehow you invented some complicated calculus to try to divine some sort of sense of what your experience would be like. So that's the kind of macro picture. But also we're doing this kind of all the time, and every time you walk through that door and you come in and you sit down, there's usually some sort of quick projection or evaluation of how this sit's going to be, what the possibilities or the capabilities are. And some of that could be waking up some discernment. You know, if you're kind of measuring sort of how energetic the mind is, or how collected it is, then you can be using wisdom and discernment to maybe chart a course. But that's very different than this kind of emotionally laden wishing and hoping and fearing and fretting about how the afternoon's going to be. And I remember it all too well from the first couple of years that I started to practice. It just seemed... it seemed impossible to get over that, not just in sort of individual or particular sits, but especially for like a retreat. I mean, you know, there's something that motivates us to take this time out of our lives and to come up here. And it seems kind of built into that motivational structure to have images, expectations, and goals. So, and before we came up here, I was talking with Scott and Joan and Susan once we arrived at their house, and I was saying I think it took 10 years before I learned how to sort of not feel anxious at the beginning of a retreat. like no sense of worrying and kind of that whole habit of even trying to figure it out just kind of finally starting to deflate, collapse. I think Joan's comment was, oh no, only 10 years. I got 10 years. Or something like that. So, but no, that's probably not your terrain. Mileage may vary. Also, one of the related sort of themes with this is, often since we moved to White Sam, and I kind of I have the chore of giving some reflection and Dhamma talk sort of after the meal and also at our kind of regular meditations in White Sam and in Portland. And it's a bit disconcerting. Like when I give Dhamma talks and I talk about the various problems that I've had in my own sort of practice, people always kind of come up later and sort of say, oh, thank you, that was such a good talk. And they're so glad to hear how mightily I struggled with this aspect or that aspect of my practice. And I always feel a little bit, I mean, it's understandable, but I always feel a little bit frustrated because the guidelines that the Buddha sort of lays out for giving reflections and Dhamma talks are, you know, not to personalize it so much. So, and sometimes people feel very relieved, but also, I can't help but think that sometimes I'm sort of like damaging people's faith, you know. Sort of think, my God, he still has anger. Which, you know, is kind of good. Good and bad. So it's good for people to be realistic and not live in some fantasy about where various people are in their practice. But, you know, these comments that kind of come back from people, it's another just further kind of testament to this whole habit that we have of, you know, creating an immense amount of strife and struggle and suffering around sort of creating some ideal and some sort of image about what we think our practice should be giving us, what we should be experiencing at every sort of step of the way. So part of my encouragement, you know, during this retreat is really to, as much as you can, to try to really just dismiss that, sweep that away, dispel it, pop that bubble of delusion, and just get back to the practice, get back to sort of doing it. Or one thing I've also found really helpful in practice is kind of consciously challenging it, saying, every time you come and you sort of sit down, you don't know where this practice is going to go. And that's really the truth. And it's a very hopeful kind of reflection that can bring a great kind of like openness and energy sort of into a sit or a period of walking meditation. So I went through a period of time where you know, I really like used that sort of in my practice. And, you know, I would sort of sit down and I'd feel this kind of anxiety or this kind of projection starting to kind of gain some real momentum and some kind of gravity. Especially in the midst of a retreat. You kind of get up and you sort of, oh, I'm kind of sluggish this morning, first meditation, well, that didn't go so good. Okay, let's get some walking. Okay, now we eat. Okay, here we go. Morning time. Okay, I'm going to really try to make this 3-hour chunk work this morning. And you can start applying yourself to it. And, you know, if by 1 p.m., 2 p.m., you're not feeling some sense of okayness or acceptance of how the practice is unfolding, and instead there's this great mismatch of how you're feeling and how you expect to be feeling, it's easy to get very kind of dispirited, you know. And what the mind wants to do is it wants to kind of give up, or sometimes you can just write it off and say, okay, well, I don't know, this is day 3, I guess I should have been calming down, but this is the worst. I'm more restless today than I was on day 1. And I'm already feeling achy and bored, and I just can't connect with my breath at all. And it's only 2:00. And the mind wants to say, okay, I'm just going to have to write this one off. Maybe day 4 would be better. Right? And, you know, if you're a disciplined meditator, you still hang in there and follow the schedule. But you've already decided to write it off, really. Or you've kind of readjusted your expectations to something maybe not so inspiring. And so, you know, it's like in those moments, you know, one thing that can lessen that pain is drop it. Just drop it. No matter how true it seems, no matter how much you want to believe it, it's like, you know, you can have all the evidence in the world, but the reality is, you don't know the terrain. You don't know where this next hour is going to lead you. You don't know what tonight's going to be like. And, you know, in my life as a practitioner, I've had many experiences of this, which is, you know, one of the reasons why I've been able to relax that habit in my own practice. Because many times I've kind of come into a sit and I thought, okay, here we go, another 60 minutes. God, I can't wait till I ring the bell. I mean, I'm just going to be sitting here in agony, and I just can't settle down today. This restlessness is just throwing me around. But whatever. And then something just shifts unexpectedly. Or there's many times outside of retreat, just in the flow of monastery life, where I've been very engaged with duties and responsibilities and work. In the end of the day, at our monastery in California, we always have evening puja religiously, and you know, sort of sometimes in the middle of a really heavy work project, you know, day after day, it would just be everything I could do to like not collapse on the cushion. You know, you know, come in and just fully expect kind of dozy, unmindful, deluded states of mind, and think, okay, well, boy, today was, boy, it was a rough day. I've been going all day. I'm exhausted. It's hot. This is going to be a disaster. And then sometimes I sit down and all of a sudden this energy just kind of aligns itself, and there's this incredible collectedness and stillness. Just like, wow, out of the blue. So, don't believe it. As Ajahn Chah encouraged us, just look at your mind, point the finger and say, liar. And if you've known a good liar, they're very persuasive. You want to believe them. It feels right to believe the mind. So, that's why you need the finger. You gotta point the finger. It's not enough to say it. You gotta point the finger and say, liar. That's the only way you're gonna pop the bubble. Oh. And then don't overcompensate and then start to, you know, sort of say, you know, create some alternative expectation. Just walk the path. Just apply yourself with sincerity and right effort. At its simplest, you know, right effort is kind of responding to the conditions we have and doing that simple evaluation, you know, whether this is a skillful or unskillful mind state, and then responding to it in an appropriate way. Wholesome states are arising, nurturing and supporting those. Unskillful, unwholesome states are arising, learning how to dispel them, learning how to overcome them. And with energy and effort, putting in the causes, laying the foundations for an increase in wholesome states, a decrease in unwholesome states of mind. So one of the other things that I'd like to sort of suggest to kind of brighten your time here is to really cultivate the habit of joyfulness. Ajahn sort of mentioned this the other night. And you know, it is really a habit to kind of be made much of. No matter how strong your countervening habits are, I sort of have some sort of clear memories of just how wrong this kind of felt when I first came across this. I'd been sort of reading the Visuddhimagga, the first year I was in the monastery, and looking a lot of the advice that's in this kind of ancient commentary about how to cultivate the various meditations, and you know, starting to sort of become all too aware that I had this very cynical, pessimistic kind of half-empty habit that was well-honed in art school at my liberal university. We were very good at sort of unwisely attending the fall, as Ajahn sort of put it the other night. Nowhere was that habit any stronger. It's when I was directed towards myself. So I was looking through the Visuddhimagga for advice, like, you know, what do you do about this? I mean, it's this really durable habit to just constantly be finding the fault in everything, the fault with the abbot, the fault with the schedule, the fault with the way we do this, the fault with the way we do that, what's wrong with my practice, what's wrong with this jerk that sits next to me, what's wrong with me, why do I think he's a jerk? And then also, like, comparing myself with other people, boy, look at that guy. He looks so calm every time we sit meditation. He's just always sitting there with his smirk on his face. one of the pieces of advice in this kind of ancient commentary was talking about looking at your various personality habits, negative habits. It talks about being around people that have counterbalancing sort of habits. So, like if you have strong habits of ill will and aversion and that whole family of diseases, and then like associating with people that are kind of loving and kind and friendly helps you find balance and creates kind of positive conditions to start to extract yourself from those habits. Anyway, somewhere in my reading, as going through this, there's just this instruction to sort of cultivate the habit of joy, and so I remember sort of like picking this up and as a practice for myself. Okay, well, every day I'm going to sort of try to spend a bit of time just kind of arousing sort of joyous kind of perceptions in my mind. And everything about it just felt wrong. not that I hadn't ever experienced joy in my life, of course, but somehow you come up against this sort of paradigm that, genuine emotion and genuine, somehow there's something more genuine about an experience when it just happens to you. So, one of the first things that I kind of came up against was just this sort of belief that somehow it's cheating to kind of change your mind. somehow intrinsically who I am is the guy who sees the cup as half empty. And so to kind of connive and in the midst of this kind of cynicism, to sort of pretend to be joyous, or to, sort of manufacture a kind of joyous perception, it felt like dishonest. It's one of the first obstacles to sort of practicing that. It just feels like I'm not really feeling joy. I'm just making this up. It's just like think pink or something. It felt a little unnatural and uncomfortable, but then all of a sudden it sort of dawned on me that I'd never in my life challenged that sort of belief or that sort of assumption that just because I'm feeling something by chance, it doesn't necessarily make it somehow intrinsically valid and true. The kind of chance emotions, the kind of good day, bad day kind of thing. Like, you know, somehow I never really kind of seen that as this kind of as a part of my worldview, I guess. But somehow I believe that that is not just the way things are, that's the way things ought and should be. That emotions are things that happen to us based on who I am. And you know, maybe to some logical extension, what I deserve, what I've earned, what I've deserved, who I'm meant to be, who I really am. You know, so part of that dissonance that can arise from them might come from the very attachment to your identity. You know, at the time I had this fairly strong identity that, you know, although I could experience joy, I really was the kind of half-empty pessimist type. And for me to consciously kind of do something with the mind was kind of somehow dishonest or fake. But, you know, then there's, boom, just this kind of insight that arises in my mind after working with him a little while. It's like, you can change your mind. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't, and as Ajahn Sona says, you know, for no good reason at all. You don't even need a good reason. You can change your mind. And you know, somehow that idea just finally kind of hit me upside the head. And so then, you know, then I sort of just kind of took it on as a practice. And I'd still say I have maybe an inclination towards being a bit pessimistic. You know, I've taken it on as part of my life's work to not nurture that aspect of my being, and to find ways to just generate kind of lightness, joy, positivity, and I no longer feels inauthentic or fake. Just see it as part of right effort. Or, to put it in a more common way, just see it as a way to sort of balance the mind and encourage brighter, more peaceful states of mind. So, and it gives kind of energy to sort of practice this and to abandon your habits of fault finding. And in this place, there should be no problems finding things to delight in. I've just been really enjoying the extra light that we have up here this time of year. It's really nice to wake up early in the morning and to be able to watch the sunrise from my kuti. Normally sunrise only happens during morning puja in the places where I live. So to be able to still kind of be in my kuti and watch the sunrise and still make it to the first sit of the day on time, it's really beautiful. And I can see out over the marsh, listen to the birds. The silence of this place and the feeling of solitude. I generally live in pretty quiet places, and half, or most of the time, I've been a monk. But this monastery and the setting here in particular is just very strong silence. It's quite devoid of sounds of traffic, sounds of people and talking. There's this wonderful natural silence of the wilderness. Which is something my mind is kind of delights in. It's like, especially when the evening sit is done and I'm just walking back to my hut. You can just hear the gravel or the sand kind of crunch under your shoes. You hear the birds. You hear the aspen leaves. And sometimes you just you can't hear anything at all. It's just really quiet. And this situation, the facilities here and the teaching and company we have, it's no matter how many times I come on retreats, it always strikes me as such an incredibly and a precious opportunity, which should be delighted in. It's all too easy to spoil it with fault finding, either in yourself or in the place or in your companions or the food or your room. But in many ways this really is as good as it gets in the human realm. And we have a retreat arrangement like this, it's a shame not to really find joy and delight in it. And that's really kind of in some sense our responsibility in being here. You can come on a retreat, you don't have a lot of responsibilities. The chief one is to be sincere in your efforts, to be with yourself and your experience, and to put forth right effort, but also to relax and enjoy it, find some ease and sort of delight in these kind of conditions. There's few places in the world this quiet, this safe, this supportive, this beautiful. We even come at the right time of the year. The mosquitoes are patiently waiting for us to leave before they come out to harass the Canadians. They know how hard it is to be an American, and so they're on a holiday right now, just waiting for the Americans to leave. They know how stressful it is south of the border there. And one thing that can kind of support that is really using the time as much as possible to kind of turn inwards. I mean, one of the kind of really unique kind of gifts of a meditation retreat is, you know, we have this temporary sort of community of seekers. And, you know, the way this facility and our time is arranged is you should look on it as a gift. You have complete permission to turn inwards, to really know yourself and be with your experience. And, you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't look at others or whatever. If you catch somebody's eyes as you're walking by, give them a nice smile. If you see somebody doing something worth rejoicing in, rejoice by all means. But you don't have the same kind of social conventions and expectations and duties and responsibility. You know, when you see your friend in the world, in the workplace, you know, you have to be present for them and hi, hello, and, you know, and how are you doing? And if they say not so well, or if they look sad or dejected, then you have to say, oh, what's wrong? And, you know, even if you don't really care. But, you know, in this space, you know, as you are living with each other here, kind of practicing and stuff, you know, really give each other and yourself complete permission to turn inwardly and really know your own experience and enjoy your own experience as much as possible. We really rarely get those kind of opportunities in our lives. And can be a bit of a struggle and a challenge, but it's that place where you will find freedom. Ajahn Chah's encouragement was to spend 90% of your time focused on yourself. Don't worry about other people. So the focus of the practitioner really should be on their own experience. And I like to say being 100%, 90% of the focus should be on yourself, but be 100% responsible for your experience. And that doesn't mean to attach to it or identify with it, but, you know, try to get to this place where you're really feeling the experience from the inside out. It's expected, it's normal, it's unremarkable that there are faults in the world and disagreeable sights and sounds and smells and roommates, neighbors, food, clangs and bangs. But in the context of a retreat, really, you have this kind of opportunity to feel that from the inside out. So if you're feeling like, you know, when the mind does slip into some sort of negativity, try to sort of find some way to shift your perceptions and awareness that supports feeling 100% responsible for that. Just imagine like no one else exists. So, you know, it's like, you know, don't create a you and a them, and just imagine that your experience is coming completely from your own response, because it is. So, you know, if there is annoyance or aversion or something sort of arising, that is your response. It's always interesting, like, you know, it's inevitable that there's disturbing sounds and stuff unfolding during a retreat. And you know, one thing I always like to do with my mind when I start to get notice agitation or aversion rising to some particular sound is try to find some other sound, you know, sort of out in the environment that I don't find disturbing. And I think, okay, so this one I don't like, and this one I don't care about. Why is it I don't care about that one? And so often it's, you know, it has to do with personalities. Yeah. So whenever we can sort of project some sort of, again, images and expectations that we feel are being violated. You know, like I said the other day, I'm walking out here and this helicopter's flying by. And my God, it takes a long time. Those things are so loud, you hear them from it's a long ways away. And just, you know, and he's kind of violating our silence here. And I'm sort of listening to this and think, wow, that's kind of annoying. And then I thought, oh wait, maybe he's flying up and down the power lines. You know, he's just got a job to do. He's got to fly up and down the power lines, make sure everything's okay. There's no terrorists getting ready to blow up the Canadian grid right now. The trees have fallen. And so my mind starts to calm down a little bit. It's okay, he's just doing his job. But then I notice he's not flying over the power lines. And I thought, oh God. Now, I mean, come on. He knows there's a monastery here. I mean, why does he have to fly over the monastery? And it's so low and so loud. But then I start walking back later at night, and these birds, they're making the most incredible sounds, and it just delights my mind. And they're louder than the helicopters. And they go on for a lot longer too. It's like, oh. So is it the sound? Is it the volume? Is it the time? This always comes back to these images and expectations that we feel are somehow being kind of violated. And, you know, life, you know, the hopeful message is that we are able to respond. That's where freedom lies. You know, that's what we really want to learn, this kind of 100% responsibility in the sense of, you know, being able to respond in a skillful way. It's unremarkable that life presents us with disagreeable sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, ideas. And, you know, part of growing up and maturing spiritually is to just learn how to cultivate that habit of being okay with it all. Yeah, it's like, I kind of see it now as a sort of emotionally stuck in my toddler phase when I start sort of overreacting to silly things like that. So, and that will be a gift to yourself and gift to all of your fellow retreatants. And if you can be 100% response able. So I should probably end here. I kind of failed on two accounts tonight. I was going to talk about metta. I never got there. In my dream, inspired by TED videos. You guys have seen these TED Talks. My dream is to learn how to give wonderful Dhamma talk in 20 minutes or less. I don't want to get Ajahn-itis. But didn't happen tonight. So I'll leave these thoughts for your reflection tonight.